listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
Welcome you all to this session. Our two papers, and I'll make my introduction brief because the papers are fairly lengthy. Dr. Brian Hales will present the first paper. Just as a little background, he has a sister. She and her husband got into fundamentalist Mormonism and became interested in plural marriage, took a second wife, and because of his concern and love for her, he decided as an act of LDS that he would try to set her straight. And so he started doing some research on the subject of patriarchal priesthood and authority, and because of his research, wrote her a series of letters. And as a bottom line, she is still active in the fundamentalist movement, and he is still very active in the LDS Church. But his research has been the result of which has is his paper, and later on will be a full-length book. He has worked very closely with Max Anderson. Many of you are familiar with his name as the author of Polygamy, Fiction, and Fact. He was unable to be here today since he's out of town. But the information that will be presented today is in total agreement with his viewpoint and research. So we're glad to have Brian here with us. And he's also an anesthesiologist up at the Layton Humana Hospital. Fred Collier will be the respondent. Fred has been involved in research for Mormon history and doctrine for over 20 years, is the author of Unpublished Revelations and Teachings of Brigham Young, as well as numerous pamphlets, mostly on the subject dealing with priesthood. Both are very qualified in this area, and you'll hear definitely the pro and con side of priesthood authority and Mormon fundamentalism. So we'll turn the time over to Brian for his paper, hopefully about 30 minutes. It may be a little shorter, which he's requested that additional time be given to question and answers at the end. And then Fred will respond in about 15 minutes.
Well, I appreciate that introduction from Ann, and before I get into the paper, and I will read most of it, I wanted to just mention a couple things. I appreciate having my wife here. She's running the slides for me. And there are slides and handouts, and I think we're probably out of handouts. If you want a handout or information on the book that will be published, you can just give me a name and address or something. I can send a piece of paper around or something, but just let me know and we'll get it to you later on. For the tape is not running, is that right? I was just going to say, you don't have to have a handout or see the slides to understand the paper. Max apologizes that he's not able to be here. He really feels bad, but had another commitment that just precluded him from being here with us. He is aware of everything that will be said, and we've been collaborating on the book that, as I mentioned, will be coming out within the next year. I'd also like to just take a second and apologize to Fred, because I am going to cut down the paper just a little bit, cut out things that I think are of less importance, to give us a little bit more time in the question and answer period, because there are some other items that I have, I think, are of greater importance than the things that are in the paper, things that I did not know about at the time the paper was written about 5 months ago. Recently, a variety of news events in the Intermountain area have highlighted polygamous families, and the infamous activities of the LeBarons of the Singer Swap Group have cast a negative shadow on people that are generally very tranquil and God-loving. The publicity that has been given to the individuals trying to live the law of plural marriage has exposed Mormons and non-Mormons alike to their theology, their hopes, and their faith. One important element of their faith deals with the authority to perform marriages that will endure through eternity. The Lord stated with respect to the sealing authority that there is never but one man on earth at a time upon whom the keys of this power and priesthood are conferred. This one man is referred to as the one whom the Lord has anointed and appointed, or him who is anointed unto whom I have appointed this power. The importance of obtaining and utilizing the authority given to this one man when performing any eternal marriage is illustrated by observing that him who is anointed and appointed is referred to four times in the first 19 verses of D&C 132. Likewise, yes, I'm fine. Thank you, Ann. I can't see, the lights have been dimmed.
Ryan?
The Lord stated that marriages for time and for all eternity that are not through Him who I have anointed and appointed under this power are not valid nor of force when they are out of this world. Even various polygamous factions themselves condemn each other over this important concept. And despite the claims by prominent polygamist authors that there are more polygamists today in the Intermountain area than there were at the time of the 1890 Manifesto, such truthful observation should not imply unity among these people. They are collectively called fundamentalists, a term derived from their desire to return to fundamental practices that they believe have been inappropriately discarded from the Mother Church. One of the main doctrines which divides those practicing modern polygyny is that of authority. As can be seen from the handout, several distinct lines of sealing authority are claimed by various polygamous groups. And on the far right-hand side, you have what I've called independent independents. These individuals believe that they can obtain the sealing power directly from God. They have a direct communication from God. Or they ascribe to a concept called divine concubinage. But regardless, they don't seem to give too much concern to the one anointed and appointed. The second column from the right-hand side of the paper is the Church of the Firstborn of the Fullness of Times. They derive their authority through a person they calling called the Rite of the Firstborn. Joseph Smith purportedly held that calling and then ordained Benjamin F. Johnson, who they believe was an adopted son of Joseph Smith, gave him the keys, and then Benjamin F. Johnson gave Adair LeBaron the keys, who then gave it to some of their sons. And if there are other questions on this topic, there are greater experts in our respondent on this topic. But for contrast, that is included in the handout. The Quorum of High Priest Apostles and the recollections of Lawrence C. Woolley of his 1886 ordinations are the source of priesthood keys utilized by many polygamists today. It appears that Joseph W. Musser developed the idea of high priest apostles sometime between 1929 and 1933. Musser himself was a very productive fundamentalist writer who had been excommunicated from the church in 1921 for his polygamist activities. In June of 1933, the First Presidency issued a statement in which they declared, quote, "There is but one person on the earth at a time whom the keys of this sealing ordinance are conferred. That man is the presiding high priest, the president of the church," unquote. This clear claim to sealing authority may have been the stimulus to Joseph Musser to discover a priesthood line that would make the keys of sealing available to him and his fundamentalist followers. Later that same year, Musser co-authored a pamphlet entitled A Supplement to the New and Everlasting Covenant of Marriage, which included the first description of a priesthood quorum that existed external to the church and presided over it, comprised of seven high priest apostles. This quorum was also called the Council of Friends, and these titles of friends and high priest apostles are derived from D&C 84, verse 63, where the Lord referred to 10 elders as mine apostles, even God's high priests, ye are my friends. Hence the titles of high priest apostles, you juxtapose the two words, and then the title of friends. Prior to that publication, the terms high priest apostle, the term high priest apostle was unknown among any of the speeches or writings of the early priesthood leaders. With one exception, Wilford Woodruff mentioned it in conjunction with 70 apostles and all other apostles, where he was clearly using the term as special witnesses of Jesus Christ and not as members of a lofty priesthood quorum or as a priesthood office. An examination of the individuals referred to as friends in the remainder of the Doctrine and Covenants fails to identify a distinct quorum or group of men. Musser's high priest apostles were apostles of a higher order. This slide is a little messy. It's on the back of your handout. Musser's high priest apostles held more authority than members of the Quorum of the Twelve, which were apostles of the church. The high priest apostles preside as a quorum over the church through the First Presidency and over the kingdom of God, through the Council of 50. God's prophet, the president of the priesthood, the senior apostle, and the one anointed and appointed were all encompassed by a senior member of the council as described by Joseph Musser. In his writings, Musser proposed 14 groups between 1829 and 1880, which he believed comprised a quorum of high priest apostles in their respective time. Those groups seldom contained seven members, and the individuals were constantly being shifted in and out of the quorum without apparent reason, but they are still listed by Musser as evidence that his quorum of high priest apostles existed from a period from before even when the church was organized, and that they were capable of transmitting the keys of sealing to polygamists today. The idea that two levels of apostleship could possibly exist may come as a surprise to some Latter-day Saints. Brigham Young taught concerning the apostleship, the keys of the eternal priesthood, which is after the order of the Son of God, are comprehended by being an apostle. All the priesthood, all the keys, all the gifts, all the endowments, and everything preparatory to entering into the presence of the Father and the Son are in, composed of, circumscribed by, or I might say incorporated within, the circumference of the apostleship. And there's lots of other quotes that are available to us. In light of these teachings, successfully promoting a higher level of apostleship is difficult. Several authors have recently detailed polygamist activities of many church members after the Woodruff Manifesto of 1890. That several hundred, I think D. Mike Quinn has identified 275, such marriages were authorized and performed cannot be doubted. An examination of the sealing authority utilized to effectuate these polygamous unions after the 1890 Manifesto reveals four sources. From 1890 to 1907, the LDS Church president, in almost every case. 1907 to 1922, two sources, unauthorized apostles and patriarchal authority. And then after 1922, we have the recollection and the utilization of 1886 ordinations. There are attempts by fundamentalist apologists today to suggest a similarity between the marriages between 1890 and 1907, which were performed at that time with authority of the LDS Church president, and those that they perform today. However, the source of the keys of sealing used by the two organizations is very different. Modern polygamists claim authority through an occult line that originated with Lawrence C. Woolley's recollections of 1886 ordinations, not through the senior apostle that has been passed down as we see with the LDS Church president. During the 1907 to 1922 period, two sources were claimed, one through unauthorized apostles such as Matthias Cowley, who purportedly commissioned John W. Woolley to perform polygamous marriages prior to Woolley's excommunication in 1914. Matthias Cowley denied that he had ever done this. The second source relied on Doctrine and Covenants, section 124, verses 92, 93, and 124, where the Lord stated that the church patriarch held sealing blessings so that, quote, whatever he shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, unquote. In 1911, Judson Tolman, a stake patriarch, was excommunicated for performing plural marriages utilizing patriarchal priesthood. Sometime in the early 1920s, a man named Lawrence C. Woolley, then in his 60s, remembered that he and his father, John W. Woolley, had received authority from John Taylor in 1886 to carry on plural marriage regardless of the path that the church was to take respecting polygamy. For over a decade prior to the 1920s, Lawrence C. Woolley had been remembering interesting personal experiences that he said he had had with the priesthood leaders during the 1880s. And to implement in the 1920s his newly remembered details about the 1886 ordinations, all that Lawrence C. Woolley had to do was simply elaborate a little bit more on some of the stories he had already been telling to the believing polygamists. In 1912, Lauren Woolley had signed a statement that said, quote, in the latter part of September 1886, the exact day not now being known to me, President Taylor was staying at the home of my father, John W. Woolley, in Centerville, Davis County, Utah, unquote. The account proceeds to relate how John Taylor received a visitation from Joseph Smith and Jesus Christ, which lasted most of one night. Their conversation concerned polygamy. The day after this visit, John Taylor was quoted as having said in an 8-hour meeting regarding a manifesto, quote, brethren, I would suffer my right hand to be cut off before I would sign such a document, unquote. The 1912 account of Lauren Woolley says nothing about priesthood ordinations or authority to continue plural marriage. It is devoid of any reference to any new revelation. It is a simple statement of what Lauren Woolley proclaimed had occurred many years previous. It appears that sometime between this statement, the 1912 statement, and 1929, Woolley remembered additional details. One of the details happened to coincide with his becoming acquainted with a revelation given to John Taylor while Taylor was staying at the home of his father on September 27, 1886, and the revelation concerned the new and everlasting covenant of marriage. In 1886, in this revelation, it has an interesting history. It is in John Taylor's handwriting, but it was never presented to the church or the priesthood leadership for acceptance. It was discovered among the papers of John Taylor by his son a few months after his death. It is significant for four reasons. It is important for what it says. It states that the Lord would not revoke this law. And fundamentalists have interpreted this to mean that the Lord could never suspend the practice of plural marriage. Second, it is important for what it does not say. It does not talk about authorizing individuals to continue plural marriage. It does not talk about the one man, anointed and appointed. It fails to mention the organization or reorganization of any priesthood council upon that date. Third, The date written on the top by John Taylor. On the top of the revelation is the likely source of the specific date for Lawrence C. Woolley's 1929 version. Recall in 1912 he signed a statement saying that he didn't remember when it had happened. He becomes acquainted with the revelation that has the date on the top, and then he remembers the exact dates for his 1929 account. Number four, as the church endeavored to suppress the knowledge of this revelation, polygamists rallied to reveal the attempted cover-up. Church leaders wished to eliminate the awareness of this revelation, even to the point that in 1933 the First Presidency said it was a pretended revelation and stated it was not found in the archives of the church. This was unfortunate because it appears that certain of the associated church leaders did indeed have a knowledge of this revelation and its existence and location, and as a fundamentalist missionary tool, the attempted cover-up of John Taylor's 1886 revelation should not be underestimated. The exact year that Lawrence C. Woolley began talking about the ordinations in conjunction with the 1886 activities is not really known. Reuben Allred indicated it was 1921. Joseph Musser's diary, the first account, is in 1922. The most complete account was written by Joseph Musser in 1929 and signed by Woolley. It recorded that John Taylor, quote, then set us apart and placed us under covenant that while we should live, we would see to it that no year passed by without children being born into the principle of plural marriage. We were given authority to ordain others, if necessary, to carry on this work, and they in turn were given authority to ordain others when necessary, under the direction of a worthy senior by ordination, so that there should be no cessation in the work. Lawrence C. Woolley claimed that five men, John W. Woolley, Lawrence C. Woolley, Charles Wilkins, Samuel Bateman, and George Q. Cannon, were given priesthood power to do three things. One is to perform marriage ceremonies. The second is to ordain others to perform marriage ceremonies. And the third was to ordain others to perform marriage ceremonies under the direction of a worthy senior. The account of the priesthood ordinations did not attempt to correlate in any way the authority that he said was conferred with the numerous statements on the priesthood found in the Doctrine and Covenants. Specifically, it did not address three important questions. What authority was given? Were these men ordained high priest apostles? Or were they just given the apostleship? Or were they given a special authority? Second question, what priesthood council was formed, if any? Was it a council of high priest apostles or a council of friends? A special quorum of apostles or just a special council? And then thirdly, what is the relationship of the calling of the worthy senior? How does he relate to the prophet, the president of the priesthood, the one anointed and appointed, the president of the church? Does this individual hold the keys of the gathering given to Joseph Smith in 1836 and promote missionary work? Does he hold all of the keys of Elijah and promote work for the dead? None of these questions were addressed in the most expanded recollection of Lawrence C. Woolley's ordinations, the 1929 version. Secondary sources serve to enlighten us on a few of these points, but overall we are indebted to subsequent fundamentalist authors like Joseph W. Musser for the details. There is nothing to support the notion, at least that I've been able to find, that Lawrence C. Woolley believed in or taught about high priest apostles. He did teach about great high priests, but I believe the term high priest apostle was one more coined by Joseph W. Musser. As one reviews the volume of scripture that the Lord has given us to understand his priesthood, the dearth of specifics regarding these ordinations is a definite contrast. For Latter-day Saints, there are other problems with Lawrence C. Woolley's ordinations. The teachings and the actions of the five men fail to support the idea that they were authorized and commissioned to continue plural marriage in 1886. George Buchanan didn't need an ordination in 1886. He already held the keys. He already had received the ordinations. However, he continued to promote polygamy during the 1880s and 1890s, but he was also a staunch public supporter of the 1890 Manifesto. This behavior would seem inconsistent with a man who had witnessed John Taylor forcefully declare in 1886 that he would rather have his hand cut off than sign a manifesto. The 1929 account states that Taylor was actually levitated above the floor and his face was illuminated when he said it. This would impress most individuals and probably convince them that they would do well not to advocate such a document, but next to Wilford Woodruff, George Q. Cannon was the manifesto's best public supporter. Samuel Bateman was a bodyguard of the Brethren. He is important because he had a journal, and it is available for us today. This journal contains nothing to support the idea that he was given authority in 1886 to perform plural marriages, or commissioned to see that no year passed without children being born into the principle of plural marriage. His journal is also devoid of any evidence that he ever performed or authorized anybody else to perform a plural marriage. The lack of evidence is so complete that some fundamentalist writers have suggested that the polygamist activities are recorded in his text in code. No one has broken the proposed code, and a simple reading of the record reveals a text that's consistent with other journals of the time using a few abbreviations for commonly used words, but otherwise just describing his daily activities. Charles Wilkins was a bodyguard to John Taylor, Wilfred Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, and Joseph F. Smith. And while less is known about him than the other four proposed witnesses, available evidence fails to suggest that he ever performed a plural marriage for anyone before or after 1886. Wilkins was a polygamist prior to the 1890 Manifesto, but his marital relationships were always consistent with the counsel continually received from the church presidents that he was guarding. This included obeying the 1904 Joseph F. Smith Manifesto. Wilkins died in 1914, and full fellowship of the church, apparently having failed to use the authority Lawrence C. Woolley would later claim he had received in 1886, and also in the charge to see that no year passed by without children being born in plural marriage. When Lauren Woolley began to make his authority claims in the 1920s, the only other living potential participant was his father, John W. Woolley, who was in his 90s at the time. Some secondary sources suggest that John W. Woolley supported his son's claims, while others submit that Lauren did all the teaching. There does not appear to be any primary source to support the notion that John Woolley believed his son's ideas. Fred may have some comments on that. I've been unable to locate them. John Woolley did indeed perform plural marriages after the 1904 Manifesto, and when President Joseph F. Smith learned of it, he was excommunicated. However, during the excommunication proceedings, John W. Woolley did not attribute his authority to any 1886 ordination, but instead assumed it through a statement from Matthias Kelly. Matthias Kelly denied that he'd ever made the statement. John Woolley had been a temple sealer before that, and he knew the sealing ceremony. And he claimed that Matthias Kelly told him to go ahead and do the marriages, which Matthias Kelly would later deny. Additionally, John W. Woolley did not have any children after 1885, and these actions just seem a little inconsistent with somebody who might have received the authority and commission that his son said he had received. As a witness of the proposed 1886 ordinations to continue plural marriage, even Lauren Woolley has some problems. The Lord has stated, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, shall every word be established. Lauren Woolley appears to be the only primary witness of these important priesthood conferrals. Daniel Bateman, the son of Samuel Bateman, has been promoted as a second witness, but he specifically admitted in his affidavit that he was not present for any ordinations. Secondary sources can be used to enlist John W. Woolley as the only second witness, but this approach contrasts significantly with the emphasis placed on making first-hand statements of the Lord's witnesses available in the past. The second concern of Lawrence C. Woolley as a witness involves the many statements that he made that appeared to not be true. He claimed to have been an agent of the Secret Service, which appears to be entirely unfounded. It was the cause of his being excommunicated. He was not excommunicated for polygamy. He was excommunicated for pernicious falsehoods, one of which was that he was an agent of the Secret Service. He claimed that Theodore Roosevelt was a polygamist and that he and Calvin Coolidge was a member of the Grand Council of the Kingdom. And there isn't a lot of understanding given to us on the Grand Council of the Kingdom except that it contained 50 members and had non-members in it. It sounds an awful lot like the Council of 50. There may have been some confusion there. He claimed in one account that the bodies of Joseph and Hiram were carried across the plains and buried on Temple Square. Another account says that Joseph as a resurrected being actually led Brigham Young to the Great Salt Lake. He had dreams that kings would pay him tribute. And then number seven is extremely important. He taught that in 1932 he was transported to the Yucatan, and there he gave some or all of his priesthood keys to a prophet who began preaching in 1930. And there are numerous accounts of this, that he was transported there and gave some or all of his priesthood authority to a prophet there. And this is the source of the Woolley independence. If you look at the handout there, there's a line that derived their authority from the Woolley ordinations. Do not believe in a line of succession, and it is because, for many of them, they believe the keys were given to this prophet down in Mexico and therefore could not be available for the various lines today. While it appears that Lauren C. Woolley promoted plural marriage in the 1920s, his own life is a testimony that he didn't receive the authority or commission. Woolley himself did not take a plural wife until 1932 and had no children by a plural wife. His four children from his first wife all rejected his claims. In review, there are five concerns that one must deal with if they wish to believe in these ordinations. One is that the priesthood conferred seems to contrast quite greatly with the priesthood as described in the Doctrine and Covenants. Secondly, the lies and teachings of Samuel Bateman and Charles Wilkins, especially and probably to a lesser extent John W. Woolley and George Q. Cannon, failed to support the notion that they received authority or commission to continue plural marriage in 1886. Third, Lawrence C. Woolley's actions prior to the 1920s and his own personal participation suggest that he too never received the authority or commission. Number four, Lauren Woolley is the only primary witness of these important ordinations. And five, he made other fantastic claims which appear to be equally untrue. In summary, most modern polygamists realize the importance of utilizing the keys of Elijah to seal their plural marriages. In their attempts to legitimize their polygamous unions, they often criticize the confusion and the ambiguity that surrounded the discontinuation of plural marriage with authorization of the LDS Church president between 1890 and 1907. However, confusion and ambiguity do not produce priesthood authority. It appears that the 1920s and 1930s were the period for many of the fundamentalist movement to retrospectively derive their access to the Sealing Keys, many looking to Lawrence C. Woolley's recollections. Regardless of their religious affiliation, anyone believing in marriage for time and all eternity must evaluate whether that marriage is sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise through him whom the Lord has anointed and appointed to this power. Polygamists without proper priesthood authority become self-appointed guardians of plural marriage, performing marriages not valid in the world to come. I believe the modern polygamous movement did not grow as a living branch preserved by the Lord on a sickened tree. Rather, it sprouted as wild flowers in an abandoned field. Thank you.
In commencing, I want to commend Brother Hales for the time and effort which he has spent in order to make this presentation. This is not to say that I would agree with all that he has said. Nevertheless, it is my feeling that in presenting this paper, he has done the fundamentalist community a service, if only they will be perceptive enough to receive it as such. I am persuaded that it is a true saying that he who only knows his own side is not in a good position to judge. To rectify this problem, in true lawyer style, Brian has presented the strongest possible case for the other side. In the process, he has clearly pointed out some fallacies in fundamentalist thinking, which in my estimation are long overdue for a change. Sometimes the truth is a bitter pill. Nevertheless, we are all better off for it. If there is one prayer I would offer up daily, it is, O Lord God, do not let me believe a lie, but lead me into all truth. Truth is what we should all be after. There are many things which Brian has said in his paper that are deserving of a point-by-point response, but there is not enough time. Consequently, I will only be able to respond to a few of his remarks. In order to save time, I'll commence by making an honest confession where I would agree, and then spend time, the remainder, in ironing out our differences. In his paper, Brian suggests that the doctrine of the Council of Friends was a lie, which was put out by Lauren Woolley and Joseph Musser in retaliation to an even bigger lie which was palmed upon the members of the church only shortly before by the First Presidency. By this I refer to the 1933 message of the First Presidency, which was authored by Heber J. Grant's lawyer counselor, J. Reuben Clark. On this count, I am persuaded that Brian has hit the nail directly on the head. I guess that Woolley and Musser figured that one big whopping lie deserved another. Of late, some fundamentalists, in attempting to substantiate the existence of the Council of Friends, have tried to identify it with the Holy Order and the fullness of the priesthood. I will tell you what I think of such efforts. You might just as well try to dress a hippo in a small bikini as to make the Holy Order into the Council of Friends. The suit just does not fit. Why don't we all come clean and admit the truth? The time for such fables is past. The war is over. The teachings on the Council of Friends is a lie. And even if it is not as big a lie as the one told by President Grant and his lawyer counselor, it is nonetheless still a lie. I would rather believe that Lauren Woolley and Joseph Musser knew that the Council of Friends was a lie, which for lack of anything better they deliberately invented in order to beat the devil at his own game, to quote Charles Penrose. I would rather believe this than to believe that Woolley and Musser were so benighted and ignorant of the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants as to believe something so far from the truth. Personally, I don't like lies. But in any case, we do not here have time to deliberate on the morality of such tactics. Nevertheless, it is a historical fact that Wilford Woodruff and his successors adopted a policy of lies and lying as a tool to ward off the blows of a satanic government. Consequently, if we are to believe that President Woodruff and his successors were good men, and I don't doubt but that they were, then we must also believe that Joseph Musser and Lauren Woolley are in good company. Having resolved this dilemma with an honest confession, let us now get on with something worth talking about, namely the continued practice of plural marriage under the legitimate authority of the priesthood. It is my belief that there were two basic lines of priesthood which came out of the church, and for two different reasons. Brian speaks of these in his paper, but spends most of his time in undermining the line which came through Lauren Woolley. The priesthood which I hold came through Benjamin F. Johnson. Nevertheless, I also believe that certain sealing authority for the performing of plural marriages was passed down from Joseph F. Smith to John W. Woolley, who conferred the same upon his son, Lauren, who in turn passed them down to others. However, my testimony in this matter is not founded upon Lauren Woolley's testimony. I first became acquainted with the Lauren Woolley story in 1970. At that time, I did all in my power to determine if it was true. I went and met with Bruce R. McConkie, Ezra Taft Benson, and Spencer W. Kimball, and even tried to get an audience with David O. McKay, hoping, among other things, to see the diaries of John Taylor. When I asked Spencer Kimball about the four hidden revelations, I was surprised when he tactfully admitted that they were true by responding that the Woolleys had no right to publish them. As I found out later, Spencer's mother was a Woolley, and consequently he himself was related to John W. Woolley and no doubt heard the Lauren Woolley story from Lauren personally in his youth. But what then of the Lauren Woolley story? My research would indicate that the Lauren Woolley story was composed by Joseph Musser from journaled notes, which he had recorded over a period of many years. The testimony did not come from Lauren alone, but it also came from his father, Daniel R. Bateman. There are parts of the story which took place in 1885 that Lauren Woolley could never have witnessed, but which, according to the diary of Samuel Bateman, his son Daniel R. did. In other words, John W. Woolley, Lauren Woolley, and Daniel R.